Good morning. The Senate Finance Committee will come to order. Members, Thursday, February 17th, we have the Commissioner and Commissioner Showalter here with us today, and Ms. Jennifer Hasmer, the Assistant Commissioner, and Anna Ming, our State Budget Director, with us. We're going to be talking on several areas. One is the state debt, and then we'll have a presentation on the federal funds. So it should be very informative. Thank you very much, Commissioner, for being here. I will let you start off. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate the chance to testify today. I'm going to bring in a couple of our great team members just to set the stage before we start. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of MMB. And as you all know, MMB's got a number of different activities and responsibilities. You know, we're the agency with HR, human resources, and employee experience. We help with labor relations. We lead on results. We work on the accounting. That is the work of way more people than just the commissioner or the deputies. Today, what you have is with us is Jen Hasmer, our Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, and Anna Mingi, who's our new state budget director. And you know, part of the challenge of our agency is to continue to respond and constructively work through emerging problems. I really appreciate the chance to deal with both of these topics, because state debt is just an ongoing challenge, because we're trying to make sure that ultimately we follow the guidelines and the expectations of the legislature and the governor of having sustainable, low-cost debt that helps make sure that our capital investment is both affordable and sustainable, so that we don't spend ourselves into a place where we don't have the ability to do new investments in the future. And on federal funds, it's a really great dovetailed issue, Madam Chair, because as you all know, the federal funds have been a constant topic of conversation over the last year now. And with the new infrastructure bill, we're still learning about what happens and what can happen. And it's, while it's a separate pot and it's a completely separate stream of activities, it's an important one to know, and one that we're all gonna be learning together. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm gonna turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Jen Hasmer to walk through some of that state debt overview and orient the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner, appreciate that. Welcome, Assistant Commissioner Hasmer.
Thank you, Chair Rosen, and good morning to the committee. So for the record, my name is Jennifer Hasmer. I'm Assistant Commissioner, and I oversee the state's debt management. I'm happy to kick off our presentation today with an overview of state debt. Before I get going, I just want to set the context for a lot of the data that I'll be walking you through today. This is all going to be largely pulled from our November debt capacity forecast, which is a report that we publish twice a year according to statute 16A105. It's really a companion report to the budget and economic forecast. And each debt capacity forecast will contain a report on the state's current debt obligations, our debt service costs, our compliance with our capital investment guidelines, and our borrowing capacity. What you can see on the table on this page is a statement of our indebtedness from the November report. There are currently $4.4 billion in outstanding general obligation bonds, another $2.2 billion in outstanding trunk highway bonds, and about $1.6 billion in annual appropriation debt. In the column on the right, you can see that there's another $2.8 billion in authorized but unissued debt. So that is debt that has been authorized by the legislature, but the projects have not needed to access the cash yet, and we sell our bonds to meet the cash flow needs of all of the various projects. If you turn to the next slide, this is an overview of what's included in the debt service figure in our budget. You'll see that debt service includes both actual and forecasted amounts, with the actual debt service being based on what we have already sold as bonds. And our forecasted debt service has a couple different components within it. It includes the amount of debt service from that authorized and unissued figure that I showed you on the previous slide. And it also has an assumed future bonding bill cost for debt service. As you know, the budget includes a debt service cost associated with assumed future bonding bills. based on a historic 10-year rolling average. That's a practice and methodology that's been in place for about 20 years now. And that results in different calculations for even years and odd years. You can see on the slide here that in even years, the current forecast is assuming an $880 million bonding bill and carrying the debt service costs associated with that. And in odd years, it's the forecast is carrying debt service for a $135 million bonding bill. Turning to the next slide, this is derived from a more detailed table that we have published on our website. And this chart shows our historic debt authorizations over the last 10 years. The dark blue portion of the bars on the graph here represent general obligation bond authorizations. The green portion of the bars represents trunk highway bond authorizations. And the light blue portion of the bars represents authorizations for annual appropriation debt. You can generally see the trend of larger packages passing in even years, although there are some exceptions you can see here. And just to give some context, tying this back to the assumed future bonding bills that I mentioned previously, the amounts represented by the dark blue bars on this graph are what factor into those assumed future bonding bill calculations. The next slide is a graph that's derived from information in the debt capacity forecast showing our annual debt service costs. The green bars on this graph represent debt service paid from the Trunk Highway Fund for our Trunk Highway bonds. And then the blue bars represent debt service paid from the general fund. And the blue bars represent both our general obligation bonds as well as the annual appropriation debt, or the light blue portions of the bars represent the debt service for our annual appropriation debt. One little context, the little gray portions of the bars you can see in 2012 and 2013, that does represent amounts due on our general obligation debt, but those amounts in those years were paid from the tobacco securitization bonds that were authorized in 2011. So next, I'd like to share some of the results from our recent bond sales. And if you turn to the next slide, I'll start with a look at the municipal bond market. And specifically, this is a look at the municipal bond interest rates over the last 5 years. What you can see here is that rates had been trending downward since late 2018, and they still remain quite low by historical standards. You can see that peak in early 2020, that represents the market disruption for those few weeks in the early weeks of the pandemic. But largely, rates continue to trend downwards. You can see that they're coming up just a little bit. But even comparing back to 5 years ago in 2017, our interest rates are still below where we were 5 years ago. On the next slide, this I just want to highlight the successful strategy we employed as part of our 2020 bond sale, which was, you know, in the midst of the first year of the pandemic. We sold a record $1.2 billion in general obligation bonds in August of 2020, which was one of our largest one-day offerings in history. About $500 million of that sale was used for new or ongoing projects. And we received interest rates ranging from about 1.3% to 1.6% on that new 20-year debt. The other $696 million of that bond sale refinanced some of our existing debt. And that was a strategic refinancing that we employed that year that resulted in over $100 million in savings for the state. That those savings were split between the general fund and the Trunk Highway Fund. You can see that on the bottom of this slide. The next slide shows you our 2021 bond sale, which we held last September. We sold another $876 million in new 20-year bonds, and again saw interest rates very low, ranging from about 1.5% to 1.7%. After evaluating our other outstanding debt last year, we didn't have any other good candidates for refinancing. And in a couple moments, I'll walk you through some of the considerations we use in our refinancing strategies. But first, on the next slide, I just wanted to highlight for you that we really have a sweet spot each year for issuing debt, roughly August to October every year. That time period is sufficiently after session is over and between our budget and economic forecasts when the state's financial picture is largely stable and less likely to change. It does take a fair amount of work to bring a bond issue to market. We spend several months preparing an official statement, an offering document for our investors to consider, and really presents the state's financial condition to them. Our general obligation bond sales in early August have generally served the state very well, but we're by no means locked in to that schedule. We do sell our general obligation bonds first each year, and then any annual appropriation debt that needs to be sold typically follows within a month or two. On the next slide, I mentioned that we have several considerations in our debt refinancing strategies. It's typical for municipal bonds to have a call date, which is the earliest date in the future that the bonds can be refinanced on a tax-exempt basis. It's different from mortgages that we might all be more familiar with, which mortgages can generally be refinanced at any time. For the state's debt, we use a more customary 10-year call, which means we are generally locked into debt service costs for the first 10 years of our new debt. When deciding whether to refinance any of our debt, we prepare different savings analyses. We want there to be enough savings to justify the time and expense of preparing for a bond sale. And there's different ways of structuring our savings and thinking about those savings analyses. One decision is, how do you take the savings? Do you spread them out evenly over the remaining term of the bonds, or do you accelerate them and take them upfront? It's much more customary to spread the savings evenly so that the budget realizes the benefit of the refinancing over time. Another analysis we look at is, what is the value of this to the taxpayers? You can think of it as, there's a gross savings analysis, which is the difference between the prior debt service and the new debt service. And that's maybe most similar to how you would think about it from a budgetary standpoint and how it would show up on the budget statements. But we also do a present value savings analysis that attempts to discount the debt service streams, which really you're talking about obligations over a period of time, and discounts them into a present day figure. It's more of an apples to apples comparison. And generally, we want there to be at least 5% present value savings when considering a refinancing. In general, savings increase the closer we get to one of our call dates. And within MMB, we have an internal process where we're constantly monitoring the interest rate market within the context of our existing debt portfolio and consulting with our financial advisors on different savings analyses and refinancing strategies. Next, I want to shift gears to our
Assistant
capital.
Commissioner, I think we're gonna hold off for questions, if there's any questions, members. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when I listened to this, it kind of made me think about how interest rates are going up. And my question is, I've noticed that you have a lot of, I think 1 point or 2 point something that has been authorized, but you have not gone ahead to sell the bonds. So during this, you know, situation where we're going to be increasing interest rates, might it be better to go ahead and go through with that as your authorization allows you, so that we can capture that low interest rate scenario?
Assistant Commissioner Hasmer.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Rosen and Senator Kiffmeyer. Part of my answer to that question is that of the $2.8 billion that is authorized but unissued, those are projects that might be underway already, haven't needed to access the cash, they're in their early phases. So it represents a funding commitment to those projects to make sure that they can complete the work without any undue delays. Another way to respond to the question is that the current budget is already factoring in the debt service associated with that $2.8 billion in authorized but unissued debt. Even last November, when we updated our debt service forecast, rates were already trending up slightly in the future, but as I showed you on that overview of the market graph, that rates are still low, even compared to the 5 years ago mark. So the cost associated with that debt being issued over the next few years is already factored into the state's budget.
Senator, Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you. And just to follow up to that, do you, when you have authority to issue these bonds, does that authority ever expire? Is there a time limit on that?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, there is a general time limit. Generally, their projects and state agencies have about 4 years to encumber their funds. Sometimes funds get encumbered, and then it still takes another year or two for the projects to complete their cash flow and their spending. But in general, it's about 4 years.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hasner, just a couple of quick questions. You talked about callable bonds, and typically we make those callable in 10 years. If I were to look at Treasury rates, would I be looking, how would we compare to, say, our interest rates to the 10-year Treasury?
Assistant Commissioner.
Are we typically higher, lower, how many basis points?
Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt, I don't have the exact comparison on the interest rate differential right now. The 10-year Treasury rate does, you know, we follow that in the market, but there is a different municipal bond index. It tends to follow the Treasury rate. They don't move in lockstep, but if you were to match them up on a graph, you would see a general correlation between the two. But we issue 20-year bonds, so we also compare ourselves to a longer-term index in the market.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you talked about appropriation bonds and GO bonds and trunk highway bonds, particularly between the GO and the appropriation bonds. What's the spread in interest rate between those two? I mean, how much, as I understand it, we're paying a premium on appropriation bonds. How much of a premium do we typically pay?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt, we estimate that if we were comparing tax-exempt appropriation bonds to tax-exempt general obligation bonds, that there is a roughly 0.5%, 50 basis points difference between those. And if we issued taxable appropriation bonds, then it would be a full percent difference. That's just our forecasted estimate. And then really the reality is always dependent on what we achieve in the market on any bond sale date.
Senator Pratt.
And Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Hesmer, just one last question. As I understand it, maybe this will be coming up in the guidelines. I see the headline here. We typically stagger the maturity of our bonds. Is that correct? And certain percentage have to be paid. We target certain percentage being paid off in certain years, right?
Assistant Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt. Yes, I'll cover that a little bit in the guidelines coming up in a few slides. We do issue 20-year debt, and we structure that with level principal so that our principal is getting paid off evenly for any new bond issue over those 20 years. But there is a separate one of our guidelines that I'll go through in a couple minutes that adds a little bit more color to how we structure all of our debt within our portfolio.
Okay, thanks. I'll hold on.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner. This kind of goes off of what Senator Kiffmeyer was asking about, but does, you know, if we did issue those authorized but unissued bonds, is there a factor of inflation that you use to weigh the analysis when you're doing that? Because right now we're kind of in a unique situation with inflation, but is that part of the calculus in making those determinations as well?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, Senator Johnson, inflation doesn't impact state debt directly. All of our debt that we issue is issued on a fixed rate basis. So inflation, the biggest risk there would be to the cost of the projects themselves and can they be completed within the budget and the allocations that they've set. I know within our capital budget recommendations and the process that MMB ran last year in collecting information on a lot of projects seeking funding this year, inflation has been factored into the projects that came through MMB's process.
Senator Johnson. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a little shout out, if I can, going back in the presentation, Ms. Hasner, with regards to refinancing and saving the state of Minnesota $100 billion by doing so, I don't think the general public pays a whole lot of attention to anything but what they assume that we are doing wrong. It's nice to hear that. And I'm wondering in the future about with the inflation right now and what's going on, is there any talk about refinancing at all moving forward? Any of the debt that we have due to the fact that we seem to be in somewhat better shape right now, can we be looking forward to some of that, to saving more someplace down the line? Have you been thinking about that?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen and Senator Ingebretson, yes, we're always looking at our existing debt portfolio for any refinancing savings that we could scoop up. Like I had mentioned, we want there to be enough savings to justify bringing that debt to market. We wouldn't want to do it if we're just going to save 1%, because there are costs associated with any refinancing. Even though we didn't refinance any debt last year, I do expect that, you know, starting this year, there will likely be some additional candidates. And we'll just continue working with our financial advisor to really maximize the savings like we did in 2020.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator Ingebretson. Assistant Commissioner, can you explain a little bit about the tobacco bond debt that we have and where you stand with that? And I think the timelines are refinance it in September. Is that correct? Because there is some debt that we could refinance, and that would be one of them, I would assume. Maybe the stadium debt. There's other areas. Could you explain that too, please?
Sure, Chair Rosen, I would be happy to. So yes, the tobacco securitization bonds that were issued in 2012, I believe it was before my time with the state. I might have the year off by just a year there.
2011.
Those were refinanced, or those were refinanced within a couple years initially, and there are now state appropriation bonds outstanding for the balance of that debt. There's about $350 million outstanding from that issue and change right now. It is a bond issue that is a candidate for refinancing this year, so we're keeping an eye on the market. September 1st is our next principal payment date. Ideally, to capture some savings, we will be refinancing at some point before that date to really maximize the savings. But we are within a window to refinance those bonds at this point in time. In regards to the stadium debt, that is not actually the call date that I mentioned before, is not until June 1st of 2023. So we have more than a year left before we need to decide on any type of refinancing strategy for those bonds.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We might talk a little bit more about refinancing the stadium. That could be an option on the table. I think actually I have a bill that I just put in refinancing the stadium. I do have a question too about why, a very simple question. Why do we use, I know appropriation bonds have been used for the stadium or for housing infrastructure bonds, but why, what's the advantage to using appropriation bonds? And we've been using a lot more here in the future. Or lately, I should say. And what's the thought pattern on that? They're more expensive, I realize that. And why have we gone that route?
Yep, Chair Rosen, I'll be happy to explain that. The Constitution really limits the purposes for which general obligation bonds can be used and sold. And, you know, for the most part, for more than 90% of our projects, they have to be publicly owned, serve a public purpose, and be for a governmental program. There are times that projects can't fit within the guidelines that the Constitution sets for GO bonds. So appropriation bonds are just a different tool that the legislature can use. Needs to be authorized for each project or program as it comes up in turn for the types of projects that just don't meet those constitutional requirements for GO debt.
Do you have a cost analysis on the difference between GO and appropriation that you could share with us?
Chair Rosen, we don't have an exact financial analysis, but what we do when we estimate differences, when there's a proposal before us from the legislature, our interest rate assumptions for the appropriation debt are either 0.5% higher if we think it would be a candidate for tax-exempt financing, which comes with additional strings from the federal government that we need to pay attention to, or we would estimate a 1% higher cost for that debt if it needed to be issued as taxable bonds, appropriation bonds.
And obviously there's a vote difference too for GO versus appropriation, correct? Yeah.
Yes, that's true. 3/5 vote of the legislature for GO debt, and then a simple majority for appropriation debt.
Right. Okay, thank you. I do want to just go back to 2020 when we were passing legislation. Do you remember that? And there was a blackout period, and there was that time frame. That was very fascinating. Can you just explain a little of that for historical reference? I think that really would drive home your discussion about the blackout period.
Sure, Chair Rosen. I do remember that well. It was quite the year we all lived through in 2020. As I mentioned, when we're preparing for a bond sale, we're preparing that official statement. That's a statement of the state's financial condition. And under federal securities law, we need to make sure that that is an accurate picture of the state's financial picture whenever we publish that for our investors. There's a time window within surrounding any bond issue date. So up until we publish the official statement, we need to make sure it's accurate on the day that we publish it. And then after we sell the bonds, federal securities law also puts another 25-day period after the sale date, actually the closing date when we get the bond proceeds in our accounts, where if there are any material changes to the state's financial picture, we also have a very, very, very tight turnaround to get that updated information published out to the investors as well. So it became known as a blackout period in August of 2020. It was really a period that we were trying to get bonds to market, capture those refinancing savings we knew were there for the state, and trying to get it in a period where there wouldn't be those financial changes that we needed to quickly turn around for our investors.
Assistant Commissioner, how long is that time frame that you have to black out, and what type of bills or what type of legislation that cannot be passed around that time frame?
So Chair Rosen, there's not a strict prohibition on any type of legislation. Really what we're concerned about is material changes to the general fund, because that's the largely the basis that investors are interested in when they purchase our general obligation debt. And then we sell bonds, 2 weeks later we get the cash in our bank account, and from that day that we get the cash in our bank account, there's another 25-day period that runs from that point in time.
Okay, very good.
25.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Nauman, and a very good question. What is the blackout period on the front end of the blackout date? What's that period before the blackout date?
Really, that's where we need to be flexible, because we are working on our official statement for at least 6 to 8 weeks before we publish it. So during that entire time period, Chair Rosen, we are, you know, writing about the state's financial picture. And if there were a change during any of that period, we would need to quickly get that those updates factored in to the official statement. If changes happen very close to the date that we targeted for our bond sale, we would just need to do an internal calculation whether we can keep with our assumed bond sale date, or if we would need to push that so that we had the time to get all of the disclosure correct.
Okay, thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, can you give me a little idea of what the rationale of the 25-day waiting period is once we have the cash in hand?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes. It is, once we sell our bonds, usually it's one large institutional investor, some of the major banks in the country that initially purchase our bonds, but then they turn around and they sell those to secondary investors. And because they are making those trades after they purchase our bonds, there's a price associated with those. And the next tier of investors that are purchasing from those banks, they're making their pricing decisions based on everything we've disclosed. So if there is a major change in the state's financial picture, they might want to purchase at a different price in the future. So that's really why there's kind of that cooling off period. They don't call it that. It's sort of how maybe that would help and contextualize it a little bit more for you here. But it's really it's a protection for the investors.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Britson. Okay, with that, just one quick question too. When you put up the first slide, Ms. Hassmer, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much. On slide 3, the $2.8 billion of authorized and unissued, is that a concern? Seems kind of high.
Chair Rosen, I'm sure you're used to dealing with much bigger budget numbers in your profession right now. Towards the end of the slide, I will show you our ranking among all 50 states in terms of whether that is a large burden or not. In general, we have a very moderate state debt burden that even the rating agencies recognize as moderate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? I see no hands up, so please continue.
Great. Thank you, Chair Rosen. So now I will shift to our capital investment guidelines. First, why do we have these guidelines? They're really there to help guide your decision making around future capital budget packages. They help set policy goals through their limits and their targets, and they show a commitment to long-term capital planning. I'll walk through the specifics in a moment, but just in the background, why do we have our current guidelines? They're designed to allow for better comparability across states or compared to other states. They're consistent with how rating agencies are looking at our debt obligations. They're inclusive of all of the state's tax-backed debt, and they reflect the state's strong financial management. The next slide is just a list of the types of debt that get measured within our guidelines. So you can see it includes general obligation bonds, both the general fund supported and trunk highway debt. Any state appropriation bonds or other agency appropriation bonds backed by standing commitments from the general fund, lease purchase financings for real estate and equipment, and moral obligation debt. The only type of debt that does not get picked up in the guidelines is revenue debt, where it's backed by a specific fee or revenue stream that is the only resource used for repaying the debt. This next slide shows you our current guidelines. And guideline number one says that total tax supported principal that has been sold shall be 3.25% or less of state personal income. And guideline number two says that the total amount of tax supported debt, which includes both our issued debt and our authorized but unissued debt, shall be 6% or less of total state personal income. And you can see from the blue on the slide here that we are well within guidelines one and two from the November forecast, measuring the debt against our state personal income. Guideline number three takes a slightly different look at our debt. It's focused on our general obligation bonds. And it says that no less than 40% of our GO debt should mature within 5 years, and no less than 70% of our GO debt shall mature within 10 years. So the figures in blue there means we are in compliance with the guidelines because we have more than 40% maturing within 5 years and more than 70% maturing within 10 years. The rationale behind this last, actually if you stay on that slide just a second more, the rationale behind that third guideline is that it helps the state realize the cost of our bonding bills quickly. The rapid pay down allows legislatures in the future to continue authorizing new debt and just really helps provide future financial flexibility. Now the chart on the next slide is just a quick overview of how we have measured under guidelines one and two over the last 10 years. But from here, I'm gonna transition to debt capacity. I want you to keep in mind that when we measure our guidelines, that that's really focused on a point in time. You can turn to the next slide. When bonds are first issued, they will appear in guideline number two first as part of that calculation. And then once the state sells the debt, they will then appear in guideline number one. I mentioned before that we don't sell all of the debt authorized in the bonding bill at once. We work with all of our state agencies to determine their cash flow needs. And since we're in the market every year, we are generally selling bonds to meet the cash flow needs for the next 12-month period. Conversations around debt capacity are centered on how big a bonding bill could be. And what you see at the bottom here, it just restates the assumed future bonding bills factored in to the current budget forecast. The table on the next slide is taken right from our debt capacity forecast. It shows the maximum bonding packages that the legislature could authorize in the coming years. I will note that this table is only focused on guidelines one and two. And we've designed this table to maximize the first possible opportunity that the state would reach the limit in either of those guidelines. The table does assume that the maximum amount of debt, which you can see on the second line of the table, would be authorized in all of the years shown. And then the very bottom row of the table shows the resulting additional debt service costs associated with all of those authorizations. So I want to be very clear, this is not a recommendation to the legislature on the appropriate size of any given bonding bill package. It is what the current debt capacity guidelines could absorb. You can see that in 2022, the legislature could authorize a $3.5 billion bonding bill under guidelines 1 and 2, largely driven by the state's strong personal income. What's missing from this table is any analysis about guideline number 3. MMB, we typically structure our debt so that we remain in compliance with guideline number 3. However, if the legislature did authorize debt at these maximum levels, it might require MMB to structure some of our debt differently in the future to remain in compliance with the 40%, 70% tests from guideline number 3. And as I start to wrap up for you today, I wanted to dial out for these last few slides and just situate this discussion about the state debt within the rating agency view of Minnesota. So this slide is just a reminder that the state carries 3 bond ratings. You can see we have AAA ratings from Fitch and S&P, which is the highest rating possible. And Moody's has us rated at AA1, which is just one notch below AAA. So those high credit ratings translate into lower risk for borrowers and also lower borrowing costs for the state. I'll just close with a couple final charts to show you. As I mentioned before, the rating agencies do rate the state as having a moderate debt level. And this first chart here shows how Minnesota is really right in the middle of the pack among the states when comparing debt to personal income. And then my final slide shows a different look, which shows that Minnesota is below the national median when it compares debt service to our available revenues. So Chair Rosen, that is what I had prepared for you today, but I'd be happy to answer any remaining questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And that was very interesting. This last slide is based off of the November forecast, right? Correct.
Chair Rosen, I should clarify, those charts are derived from a report that Moody's publishes each year where they rank and compare all the different states' debt obligations. So that is derived, the last two charts are derived from the Moody's report from last year.
From last year, okay. And why are we just one notch below in Moody's, just out of curiosity?
Chair Rosen, they are looking for the state to come out of a recession and still continue to use all of the tools that the state has available in its financial toolbox, from maintaining our strong reserve levels to continuing to keep attention on our pension funding practices. And also that the legislature, working with the administration, can complete its work on time each year.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have for you, Assistant Commissioner, has to do with the matches, like the federal match for infrastructure. It's a big deal, big dollar amount of the match. So could you explain how issuing, authorizing, match, just give us information about that if you could. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Kiffmeyer, I believe we are going to have our federal funds discussion here in a minute.
Okay, I'll wait then.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't think we're at that point. Senator Pratt.
thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm interested in this relationship between revenue and personal income. Mainly because former Representative Vogel and I used to work on this and trying to set a guideline not based on personal income but based on expected tax receipts. And so my question is, it looks like just looking at the state-by-state comparison, Minnesota, we're paying about 3.2% of our tax receipts, but 2.3% of our state personal income. Leads me to believe that we're looking at about a 40% differential between the two. What would, if we were to go to the max personal income guideline, what would that mean as a percentage of tax receipts? Because that's actually what we're using to pay the debt. And is that on just the GO debt, or is that on, does that also include the appropriation and trunk highway debt as well?
Assistant Commissioner.
So Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt, I don't have the exact ratio, but if you flip back to the chart on the maximum slide, this one right here. That bottom row you see on the table, that represents the additional cost if all of those maximum debt authorizations were passed by the legislature. We just haven't calculated that as a percentage or a ratio to available resources within the state budget.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just looking at the chart, the differential between the 2.3 and the 3.2 is about a 40% spread. And then back on line or on page 16, the guideline is tax supported principal outstanding sold is at 3.25% of state personal income, but we can authorize up to 6%. So we can authorize one, does that also include trunk highway and appropriation bonds as well as GO? And two, would you then hold back selling bonds if we were butting up against, it feels like we were kind of expecting structurally to have unauthorized bonds, getting back to the discussion that we had before. Is that correct?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt. Because we don't sell all of the bonds at once, it is common, it is expected that debt will be issued over a period of time. For major bonding bills, it usually takes about 5 years to sell all of the debt that was authorized in that bill. The difference between guideline 1 and 2 does in part recognize that debt will be authorized, it rolls on as other older debt rolls off and rolls off quickly under guideline number 3, because that's how we structure our debt portfolio. Guideline number 2 does incorporate some additional types of debt that is not a guaranteed draw on our resources. Some of the moral obligation debt that gets factored in, which is really just a requirement that an issuer might request support from the general fund in the future, but it's not a requirement that the general fund will pay any of that debt service. That higher 6% threshold factors in some of that additional debt and how it could potentially become a liability in the future, but not all of that will always roll into guideline number 1. But to be clear, guidelines 1 and 2, they do pick up all of the GO debt that you think of in a bonding bill, any trunk highway debt, as well as any annual appropriation debt that's authorized.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So which debt would not be supported by the general fund?
Assistant Commissioner.
So Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt, the trunk highway fund debt would be paid out of the trunk highway fund. It carries a backup general obligation pledge that if the trunk highway fund was ever short on money, the state would still levy a statewide property tax to make its investors whole. There's some equipment leasing. We have a master lease program that allows some agencies to purchase their equipment. That doesn't qualify for general obligation bond debt. Those get paid out of internal service funds, for example. But we do factor it in as a tax-supported obligation and at least recognize it within our guidelines, because that is how the rating agencies also look at our debt portfolio.
Senator Pratt, good. Great, thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Any further questions? I don't see any. Assistant Commissioner, is that the end of your slide deck? Or are you going on to the federal funding?
Nope. I am happy to hand it over to either Commissioner Showalter or right to Budget Director Anna Mingy to take it from here.
Well, you did present at the Legislative Pension Commission and received rave reviews on your presentation, and really appreciate you doing that too and being here with us today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Rosen.
Budget Director Mingy, welcome. And
Morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. For the record, I'm Anna Mingy, State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. Members, I'm happy to be here today to provide an overview of recent federal funding that the state has received. I'm going to cover both funding that we've received in response to COVID, as well as some of what we know about the federal infrastructure bill. I'd like to start talking about the funds the state has received or will receive through various federal COVID relief packages. And I'm going to focus on funding that is flowing to state government, but we'll also touch on some of those other federal funding streams impacting Minnesota to help contextualize the resources that we've received. This slide outlines multiple laws that Congress has passed that has provided funding to states to respond to COVID-19. There have been, this isn't a totally comprehensive list, but I want to highlight these five in particular. I'm going to walk through them quickly because we have additional detail about specific funding provisions later in the presentation. First, in early March 2020, Congress passed the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act. This is relatively small, provided about $8 billion in emergency funding, really focusing on public health response. Later in March, Congress passed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which provided paid sick leave, tax credits, free COVID testing. It also expanded food assistance and unemployment benefits, and it increased the federal share of Medicaid going to states. The bulk of the funding that the state has received has really been in the last three items on this list. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or the CARES Act, was a $2 trillion stimulus bill, which provided loans and grants to businesses. It expanded unemployment benefits, provided direct payments to families. It supported healthcare providers and provided funding to state and local governments. The Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act, sometimes we refer to it as CRSA, that passed in December of 2020, also including a broad array of economic relief. And finally, the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, which passed in March of 2021, which is also estimated at near $2 trillion.
Director Meehy, are you going to go through how much the Minnesota received of these programs?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So this slide provides an overview of all of the federal funding that's going into Minnesota through these federal relief bills. But it divides that money into what's coming to state government versus flowing to other recipients. And when we say other recipients, that means local governments, providers, businesses, individuals, versus what's coming to the state of Minnesota. So if you look at the very bottom right hand of this table, you'll see the FFIS, Federal Funds Information for States, estimates that Minnesota will receive almost $73 billion in federal COVID funding, but of that, only $11.5 billion is expected to come to state government, while $61 billion is flowing to other recipients. We have additional detail about those state programs, but this is a good opportunity to highlight some notable funding going outside of state government. So of that $61 billion going to other recipients, you can see $51 billion of that, or roughly 80%, is on the economic assistance line. This line includes almost $17 billion in the Paycheck Protection Program and about $14 billion in economic impact or stimulus payments. Other notable funds going to other recipients, we will talk more about flexible funds going to local governments. There is about $2.2 billion going to healthcare providers through the Provider Relief Funds, which is included in the third line, Health and Human Services, and then a variety of other funding streams. Before I move on to talk more about the state specifics, are there any questions on this table?
Are there any questions on this slide? We may have more. I think we're all
just letting this
soak in a little bit, Director.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I know there's a lot of information, and
there is.
Still, we can always reference that. So this slide shows the relative distribution of the funds that the state has received, which is that $11.5 billion. You'll see the largest chunk is that flexible funding. Flexible funds refer to awards that allow the state to direct their use within a set of eligibility criteria and a specific time frame. And this committee, I'm sure, is familiar with the Coronavirus Relief Fund that came through the CARES Act. You can stay on that chart. And the State Fiscal Recovery Fund. And we'll talk more about each of those in detail.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, the amount of money has gotten so big. We're used to seeing in the upper right-hand corner the notation in thousands. This slide, the notation's in millions. And so this is how big these funds have gotten.
Right, right. Yeah, we're trying to get our head around it. Yes. Anybody else? Director Meany, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So the next biggest slide after those flexible funds is funding for education. We'll talk more about this in detail as well, but that was roughly $2.3 billion. And then it's followed by health and human services, economic assistance, and housing. We also see significant federal funding related to food security and childcare. And I don't think any of these slices are particularly surprising given the areas where the state has needed to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. So let's move on and talk more about those flexible funds. As you just saw, they played a really significant role in our response to COVID. In Minnesota, the first award I want to discuss is the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which came through the CARES Act. Minnesota received $2.2 billion through the Coronavirus Relief Fund, and of that, $1.16 went to local governments, and just over $1 billion came to the state. In order to be eligible for the Coronavirus Relief Fund, or the CRF, an expenditure must have been incurred between March 1st of 2020 and through December 31st of 2021. I would note initially when this passed, it was through December 31st of 2020, but that was extended through later legislation. The table here really illustrates how the state's allocation was spent. Almost a quarter of our award funded activities to support education during the pandemic. There was also significant spending for testing, support for at-risk populations, business relief, and a number of other response activities. There is a lot more information about all of our CRF spending, including individual forms outlining every authorization and then summary reports. And that's all available on our COVID Response Accountability Office website. So next, let's discuss the State Fiscal Recovery Fund. So Minnesota received $2.833 billion through the State Fiscal Recovery Fund through the American Rescue Plan Act. The State Fiscal Recovery Fund may be used to replace lost public sector revenue, support the public health and economic response to COVID, to provide premium pay, to invest in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. In this case, all the funds have to be obligated by December 31st, 2024. Based on legislation passed last session, 1.183 of that would go into the general fund to support operations in light of revenue loss due to COVID. $500 million was allocated to immediate COVID response, and then $1.15 billion was set aside for appropriation by the legislature.
Director Meany, we'll probably get back to that 1.15 million. Thank you. Please continue.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So on slide 32 provides an overview of the allocation of that $500 million for immediate response. So of that 500, the first $75 million was appropriated by the legislature for summer learning activities, and the remaining $425 million was appropriated for the COVID-19 flexible response account. The COVID-19 flexible response account was set up so that the commissioner of MMB could authorize expenditures, and for those exceeding $2.5 million, they were subject to the approval of the Legislative COVID-19 Response Commission. So thanks for all the various, the input from the legislature and all the number of briefings that many folks and staff have attended, because there's been a lot of activity in this account over the last months. Of that $425 million that was allocated for the COVID flexible response account, there's $3.5 million remaining unallocated at this time. The largest use of that account has been for healthcare stabilization, which is representing about $105 million. We've also spent $75 million on testing and vaccination, $52 million on shelter and rental assistance, and then a number of other uses.
Director Meagan, could you please remind me if there is any remaining amounts that are not used for testing, vaccination, education, workforce, whatever, where does that money go? Does it go back into the flexible account, or does it go into general fund? Where does that land?
So the fund is available through the governor must allocate those funds by the end of this fiscal year. And to the extent that the funds are unspent, they would return to the COVID, the state fiscal recovery fund. So it's a separate fund within the state treasury and would need to be spent in line with eligible uses of that federal award.
Thank you. Please continue.
So let's, I just covered the state flexible funds, but also want to acknowledge a number of flexible funds that are flowing to local governments. These were included in sort of that other recipients column in the earlier slide. So local governments have also received funding through the coronavirus response fund and the local fiscal recovery fund. Cities and towns received $1.4 billion and counties $1.9, totaling $3.3 billion. MMB also has significant reports on how those dollars have been allocated and spent on our website. So let's then get into some of the programmatic funds that have come to the state. As you saw on the earlier slide, education has been a really significant area of federal investment. The $2.1 billion of the total has come through two programs. The first, referred to as ESSER, standing for the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief. And that program received just over $2 billion, and 90% of that was provided to school districts through a formula, and the remaining 10% was state-directed grants to districts. In addition, Minnesota's received just over $60 million in the governor's emergency education relief, or GEAR, which has been used to provide school-age care, access to technology, mental health services, and then other training and COVID response.
Director Meagan, is there a report that is required on these funds from the school districts? How much is remaining also?
Madam Chair, I would need to check with the Department of Education on.
And if there's a time frame that has to be used, and if they're sitting on any remaining funds, what happens to those funds too?
Madam Chair, I can tell you, we of the CARES funding, which is $184 million, that has to be spent by September of 2022. The CERSA award is $686 million, which has to be spent by September of 2023, and the ARPA allocation has to be spent by September of 2024.
Yes, it would be nice if the Department of Education knows how much in each school district they're sitting on, and yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I assume, Madam Chair, there is reporting. We'll get back on the specifics of what we know and what timeline we're on.
Thank you.
So let's move into the next slide and talk about federal child care funding. The state has received significant funding to support the child care sector, and that's flowing through the Department of Human Services. DHS will receive almost $750 million in child care funding by 2025. And this is really into two funding streams. First is child care stabilization, where we have about $300 million being used for monthly grants and hardship grants to child care providers. And the next is through an increase to the child care development block grant. And this was used last session by the legislature to increase child care assistance program rates and also to provide monthly grants to child care providers and buy down the wait list for the basic sliding fee child care program. Moving on to public health, the state has deployed significant federal funds, almost $900 million has come to Minnesota for public health response. And those funds have been used for things like community and school testing, vaccine preparedness, local public health capacity building. In addition to those direct programmatic federal funds, Minnesota has awarded significant amounts of our flexible funds to public health activities. And then on top of that, we've been leveraging available resources through FEMA, which has been providing about $300 million to support our vaccination and testing programs. I'd like to touch on the additional federal Medicaid funding the state is receiving as well. As I mentioned earlier, the Families First Coronavirus Response Account established an enhanced federal match for medical assistance. And this is available for every quarter where there's an active federal public health emergency for one day of that calendar quarter. And that provision has resulted in almost $2 billion in additional federal funding to the state, $300 million in fiscal 20, $714 million in 2021, and $709 million fiscal year 2022, which is just through the first three quarters of this current fiscal year. Unlike previous awards, this is not a grant that the state can direct and spend, really. It reduces the state share of medical assistance and results in general fund savings. The state, in order to receive this federal match, the state's been required to provide continuous coverage to enrollees, and the estimated cost of that was about $490 million, which offsets some of the savings from the enhanced match. Finally, we'd like to highlight some of the federal fund maximization activities that MMB has been leading. As you all are very, very aware, the state expended significant state resources early in the pandemic in order to respond to COVID-19, with $750 million since March of 2020. But as we did sort of move quickly to respond to the pandemic, we wanted to keep an eye to fiscal responsibility. So as federal resources became available, MMB has worked to identify opportunities to shift costs off of the general fund and onto federal sources. As a result of that work, about $310 million of the original state investment has been returned to the general fund. On top of that, last year, the legislature directed MMB to maximize federal funds by reallocating general fund investments to federal funds, in particular the Coronavirus Relief Fund. At this time, we have reallocated all available Coronavirus Relief Fund balance to create general fund savings. As of the November 2021 forecast, $144 million has been shifted onto the general fund, or from the general fund onto the CRF. And that includes things like child care grants, food and shelter, and business relief grants. And as a result, it's freed up general fund dollars. So next I'm going to move on to the federal infrastructure bill. So if we wanted to talk about COVID relief, I could take questions on the COVID bills before we talk about the infrastructure bill.
Yes, thank you, Director Mingyi. Can you tell us again how much was assumed in the November forecast on the reimbursement of the federal funds?
So the forecast assumed $106 million, but that represents both money in the bank, sort of actual reallocations, and then an anticipated future allocations.
And what is that amount?
So that was, it's $144 million of actuals, and then so the remaining $12 million that we expected to, sort of FEMA reimbursement we expect to receive, that then will allow us to shift additional funds. However, Madam Chair, this is maybe an opportunity for me to urge a little caution in this space. We have noticed our FEMA reimbursement has slowed down. We have less, although we don't have current concerns with the current forecast, we are not confident that there will be significant additional funding returned to the CRF. So there is some risk because that amount that's in the forecast is not yet materialized, and we notice an increasing level of scrutiny around what's eligible. So we just caution against assuming additional available balance in that fund. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Also, one more question before we move on to Senator Pratt. In your enhanced Medicaid match, is there another quarter that we will be getting additional funding based off of the February forecast?
Yeah, that, Madam Chair, because of the Federal Department of Health and Human Services has extended the public health emergency, we do anticipate an additional quarter of federal match, which would show up in the next quarter.
Around $700 million?
No, so they would. I don't have the precise number. You'll have that in a couple weeks for you, but it would be significantly less than the $700 million was for the first three quarters of this year. It would be a fraction of
right, maybe a third of that. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my questions are maybe a little bit more technical, just trying to get an understanding of how all this works together. So, $755 billion of state funds, presumably GO funds, have been spent on coronavirus relief. And with that, we received is that the amount that we put into the coronavirus relief fund, or does that include other monies as well?
State Director.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, the $755 million is really some of those early investments the legislature made back in March of 2020. Some of the large ones, the COVID-19 Minnesota Fund was a $200 million investment. We also created the Healthcare Response Fund, which is grants to healthcare providers, $150 million, about $115 million for county relief grants, $90 million for business relief payments. So that's sort of a flavor, and we can send you the list of that 755, if that would be useful.
Okay, because thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry.
No problem.
So 310 has come back, and that was placed into the general fund, not into any of the relief funds, correct?
State Director.
Chair Rose and Senator Pratt. That's right. So $310 million really represents the savings to the general fund, which we've accomplished through a number of mechanisms. The relief funds, because we're past the time frame for the coronavirus relief fund in particular, the spending needed to have occurred before December 31st of last year. When we receive, we are pursuing we're looking for opportunities to be reimbursed in that space as well, through FEMA, for example. But when a CRF-funded activity is reimbursed by FEMA, and that creates balance there, MMB then moves eligible general fund expenditures onto that federal source to create the savings in the general fund. So that we are really not, our goal is to really maximize that funding source and return as little to the federal government as possible.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't mean to beat this too deeply, but if we set aside money into the relief fund and we prepaid those expenses that were then reimbursed coming back, And I get what you mean, that we're, you know, we're moving expenses that the state paid for. That's the whole point of reimbursement, right? We're making ourselves whole. I'm just trying to understand kind of how that money flows. And then with the last bullet point, all available balance on the Corona Relief Fund has been reallocated back to the general fund, meaning we've closed out those accounts?
Director Meehan.
Chair Rose and Senator Pratt, we have not closed out the Coronavirus Relief Fund, but we are in the process of doing so. We're working with agencies who have outstanding authorizations to close those out, understand if there's any underspending in that space. And we are also working with departments where there was FEMA-eligible activity to make sure that we are really maximizing the FEMA reimbursement there. And so we're working to close out that fund because, we're past the expenditure period for that account, but that work is not yet complete.
Senator Pratt?
I think that's good for now.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for you in regards to slide 34, and this is under federal education funding. And I'm noticing that what was used is a formula to districts, formula meaning the per pupil formula, which includes categoricals. In my district, we got a very small amount of funds by the mere fact of using that formula. So question is, who decided that this would go by formula instead of every student, every single student, no matter where they lived in the state of Minnesota, that the money that was available would go to every single student in the same amount of money? There was generous amounts of money for a whole variety of other things that would take care of some of the other needs that were generally there. But in regards to this individual, who decided that you're going to use that per pupil formula instead of every student getting the same amount?
State Director.
Chair Rosen, Senator Kiffmeyer, I am not sure the origin of the formula and whether it was determined by the state or federal guidance. So we will connect with the Department of Education to get a response for you.
Senator Kiffmeyer. Thank you very much. Another question I have for you has to do on slide 35. And this one has to do with the monthly grants to childcare providers. And there were several other things in there, but the monthly grants to childcare providers, in particular, we had worked hard to develop a formula that had many stakeholders, worked very, very hard to develop that formula. It was working quite well. A lot of people were engaged, involved. I was meeting with the children's cabinet, all the stakeholders. And then all of a sudden, a different formula was used for these monthly grants to child care providers. I remind you, there are centers, which has a lot more staff, and there are in-home family child care providers category. Generally, they have one worker, one FTE, and the centers have many more. So these in-home family child care providers put in a great deal more hours, but they were lumped in with one FTE as the centers were at 32 hours per week FTE, while in-home family child care providers put in 60, 70 hours a week in their work that they do, which put them at a gross disadvantage when it was changed to use that new formula. Who decided that we would leave what was working well, a lot of stakeholder input, and then move to this new kind of formula? How was that determined?
Director Meehan.
Chair Rosen, Senator Kiffmeyer, these child care stabilization funds were spent based on a law passed in the Health and Human Services bill last session. I know that there were earlier child care grants provided through some of the state flexible funds. And through, so we can work with the Department of Human Services to get an answer, but I'm assuming that these dollars were really directed by the legislature, and so I want to confirm that that's getting at the question that you're asking.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just always amazed sometimes when we go through these things and stakeholders have a great deal of input, and then we abandon that to choose something different. I know negotiations are negotiations, and some things like this just baffle me. And also to those, especially where the word was how much we need them by treating them unfairly, they feel not appreciated and not respected for the work they did and staying open during a very difficult time. But thank you, Madam Chair. I think the next questions that I have are on the next set of issues that we're going to deal with. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Lopez-Franzen, I see your hand.
Thank you. Just to, before we move on to a different subject matter, because I did work closely on this issue with Senator Kiffmeyer, the very first round of money came from the state legislature, so we decided where it went and with stakeholder input. The second round, or there's been multiple rounds, the other round has been federal funds, which comes with other strings attached. There's no reason we can't put more money in what Senator Kiffmeyer says, our bucket that we specified how it's going to be spent and to who it's going to go. But that's at the purview of the legislature, and we can certainly put more funding there so they have the flexibility and the parameters that we set as a working group with Senator Kiffmeyer and others involved. So I think Senator Housley was also involved. We were the first in the nation that put state money for childcare. We were kind of the model for that, and then the federal funding came afterwards. So they're different buckets, and we can certainly decide to put more money in the bucket that we like more, but that would be with state funding. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Lopez-Franzen. Senator Pratt, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe more of a request after talking to Mr. Nauman. It would be helpful if we had an exhibit that kind of showed what was appropriated, how much was recaptured, and then what our net spending is, because I think there's a lot of numbers floating around here. I just need to see it kind of in one table. And I don't know if that's something that, Ms. Mingy, that you can do fairly easily, but I think I just need to see the whole, kind of the big picture, the overall. And it would sure be helpful to see, because I believe we spent like $450 million almost in direct business relief. And so to see a number like 90 is, I'm having a hard time reconciling it.
Director Mee.
Chair Rosen, Senator Pratt, yeah, we have some information we can send you and are happy to pull together information to help you get at that question.
To help us all get it, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you, Senator Pratt. Director Mee. Members, I'd like to direct you back to the page 31, where it says the 2022 legislative priorities is $1.15 billion. That was a negotiated piece. And I know, Director Mee, I've talked with you privately along with the commissioner about this, and I've talked to several of my colleagues about the real number is $1.13 billion. Because of we did allow this in the 2021 legislation directing MMB, and that it's verified, Chapter 2, to maximize federal funds of reallocating general fund investments to the federal funds, particularly the CRF fund. This is something I just want to draw attention in those negotiations, in that room where that picture was taken. I was also there. The $500 million that was given to for this, the response of the immediate response for the governor, we thought that would be sufficient going forward. But I find out just last week that there was the $11.8 million that was taken from that negotiated piece. That was the legislature's prerogative. And so a little surprised that there was some lack of communication. And I guess my question to you, Director Mee, when you did take this money back in October, November from the $1.15 billion that we have been repeatedly saying over and over again in public, in our committee, all over, and then to find out that it's really not that amount of money, that there was a fiscal note that came in higher for the free and reduced lunch, that we had less than what we expected. Wasn't there enough money in the governor's immediate response fund at that time to assume that cost? What other funds could have been utilized to instead of taking it out of our $1.15 billion? Maybe Senator the commissioner Rosen would like to answer that too.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. You know, you're absolutely right. At that point in time, there was sufficient funding in that flexible funding pot of, it shows here at $500 million, actually it was $425 and other things had been taken up by that point in time. But we had a choice because at that point, that was allocated for a certain purpose. And as you well know, Madam Chair, there were certain questions about what some of those funds would be used for and what time period. We were really trying to make sure we managed the risk. The $1.15 billion was uncertain and was unallocated at that point in time. So I recognize that it wasn't as clear as what the outcome was. It was in the forecast book. It is in our documents. We thought we had communicated some of it, but obviously we didn't get that message through strong enough. This was, there were plenty of reasons why I think that might have happened. But the bottom line is if the 1.15, which is where you left session, was reduced by that amount because of the additional costs that we couldn't charge to education federal funds. So it ended up coming out of this $1.15 billion.
But Commissioner, would you not agree that it would have been eligible for this the governor's pot of $500 million or $425, whatever you want to say, the immediate response amount? At that time, there was plenty of resources in that fund. So I'm fascinated at the fact that this was dipped in, taken out of the legislature's pot of money without really allowing us to have a good handle on it. And not knowing that this was going to happen. I think there was a breach of communication that I'd like to point out, and we need to do better on this. Commissioner, was there another pot of money?
Chair Rosen, you're absolutely right. Clearly communication didn't work, I apologize for that, because ultimately, no, you're right, there was sort of a choice there, either gonna take it out of the allocated $500 million or the unallocated $1.15 billion. As this presentation suggests, the November forecast was had a number of moving pieces, whether it was the recapture of some of the CRF funds and the federal funds, whether it was the triggers that were included in the forecast. And I think in a large way, our yeas all kind of went to a much larger number and trying to contemplate some of that impact. That said, it is important to know that, yes, this is a kind of a fail-safe that we were directed to make sure that those costs for special session number two didn't come back to the general fund if at all possible. And this was our best solution as of the November forecast.
On a side note, Commissioner, you said that the free and reduced would be a little over $2 million. And the fiscal note came in at 11.8. That seems another big red flag going up. That seems out of line, very much so.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, Mr. Nauman.
Just to clarify that point, the fiscal note was prepared on that provision at $2.4 million. And on the final cost, there was language requesting a calculation to provide the final costs on the free and reduced. And that total, I think, came in at about 13.9. The 2.4 was paid for out of the GEARS money, which I believe was talked about earlier. And then the balance of the compensatory free and reduced provision was, that language was used from chapter two of the seventh special session to refinance that money. So there was legal authority for it. I think your your point is that there might have been other choices. And I think just trying to unpack all those pieces.
Right. And there certainly was, yes, we did give you the authority, but as again, there was a breach of communication, and clearly your slide demonstrates that too. Mm-hmm. Senator Benson. Oh, Commissioner, yes, follow up.
Oh, Madam Chair, I didn't say, and we can certainly follow up with the LBO regarding that fiscal note and any questions on it.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair, and I am glad Mr. Nauman spoke, because generally when the legislature says this is for legislative priorities, we don't mean the executive branch can just go do whatever they want. Again, this is a separation of powers argument, and so thank you, Mr. Nauman, for clarifying that there was authority in this. But again, we rely on fiscal notes, and if fiscal notes are not going to be good guidance, then let's not make it a hill to die on, as we lose the ability to trust fiscal notes. They will become less and less impactful in decision making at the legislature.
Thank you, Senator Benson. So, Director Mee, would you like to continue on with the IIJA money? Hopefully we can get that in. And we have some questions for you too. So.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm happy to move on to the infrastructure bill. That's on to slide 40. This slide provides some highlights of what we know about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So the IIJA provides $1.2 trillion in total from federal fiscal years 2022 through fiscal year 2026. The IIJA was essentially two omnibus bills packaged into one. About $650 million is the reauthorization of the Federal Surface Transportation Program. You can really see that in that large blue slice on the right with that first pie. And the remaining funds are nearly $550 million in general infrastructure investments, focusing on roads and bridges, transit, water, and other areas. Since the passage of the bill, MMB and state agencies have been working to dig into the details. The IIJA contains both allocations determined through formulas as well as a number of competitive grants. And the area where we have the best insight is in those allocations of formula grants. So the pie on the right hand summarizes some of what we know about those allocations. Minnesota is expected to receive about $7.3 billion over 5 years through those allocations. Most of this, roughly $6.1 billion, must be matched by non-federal sources. So, and all of those federal awards with a known state share are accounted for in the governor's budget proposals, either his supplemental budget recommendations or capital budget recommendations. This includes over $200 million in formula match for transportation, funding at the Public Facilities Authority for water infrastructure, match for electric vehicles, and some cybersecurity funding. The governor's recommendations also include some funding for anticipated match requirements on competitive awards. So let's move on to discuss how that 7.3 will be split up. The chart here is based on the most recent estimates from FFIS detailing the formula allocations Minnesota expects to receive. As you can see, the breakdown illustrates the real focus on transportation. So clearly, MnDOT will play a leading role in the state's implementation of the IIJA. I would note that not all of this funding is new to the state. This is really evident in the transportation space. So of that $4.5 billion in funding for roads, which is part of that 5.4, most of the 5.4 billion, only $600 million is an increase over base funding. And so it's that incremental increase where we really need to be concerned about ensuring state match above base funding. So you can see transportation is $5.4 million of the 7.3, funding for transit, over $800 million going to the Metropolitan Council, and then water infrastructure, nearly $700 million, going mostly to the Public Facilities Authority. Among other highlights, the IIJA directs $145 million for weatherization, and over $100 million for broadband. What is not part of the IIJA, you can stay back on that previous slide, is not, there's not a flexible pot of funding like we saw in the COVID response bills. So it really focuses on specific grant programs that flow to state agencies. And as a result, there's less flexibility in how we can direct the use of these dollars than some recent federal funding. Madam Chair, do you want me to continue or?
Well, we are just about time. We do have some questions, I know. And Senator Pratt, I think actually Director Meany, we are going to have to probably drill down more in this area. And we've filled up our time well. But Senator Pratt, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just kind of curious as far as particularly the Met Council's allocation, if there were, and I think the chair did a good job of kind of maybe getting to where my question was, be drilling down into what specifically the Met Council was responsible for in those, you know, in their $852 million.
Director Meany.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I'm going to suggest we have a table that provides detail underlying this chart. I just recommended send that to the committee so everyone can have that for reference.
Thank you, Director Meany. That'd be great because there are some questions about. Senator Kiffmeyer, did you have a question too on the IIJA?
Yes, I sure did, Madam Chair, and I was interested in the Met Council question. But I would say the big thing is I tried to figure out the amount of money that's needed for the match, and considering $7.3 billion, but then what needs a match is 16% of that, even still, that's a big number for the match. What's the source? What kind of sources can we use to meet the match that's required to make sure we maximize the federal funds?
Director Meany.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, there are a number of sources that could provide the non-federal match. The governor's recommendation includes match funding in both the supplemental budget bill through general fund dollars, as well as some general obligation bonds in the funding recommendations. There are also opportunities to leverage non-state sources, local governments, or even in some spaces, possibly private entities. So there really is a lot of opportunities. One thing that I would highlight is of that 7.3, a significant amount is a continuation of current funding. And that, there is funding within agency-based budgets to provide the state match for some of that funding already, in particular in the transportation fund with the state money coming from the Trunk Highway Fund to match just some ongoing federal awards. So what I would encourage the committee to focus on is the incremental increases over previous awards.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think then these slides need to be updated because there is no way by the information given here is a $7.3 billion of the total $1.2 trillion, that's the portion, and then $550 billion in new spending. Well, it's the new spending that we're interested in because that's where the new match kind of things would have to come from. So $550 billion in new spending. So is the 7.3 our portion of the 550?
Mm-hmm. You know, Senator Kiffmeyer, the more I think about this, we will be spending more time on this. Hopefully
then that's
more guidance,
great, Madam Chair, then.
More guidance will be coming through to help the department and Director Meany with this. And perhaps we'll have the transportation folks in here with us also.
Right. I think that'd be good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Director Meany. I don't see any further questions. We are beyond our time, but did a great job. With that, members, I don't believe the Finance Committee has anything booked next week except Senator Abler's nursing bill assistance, and that will be coming to Finance, and we're not certain on which day, so keep it open. Any further questions, comments? Okay. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.